Well, it's good to be back home again, however briefly. And good to worship with all of you. We're thankful for our visitors. Rejoice that you're here. I'd like to thank Don for his excellent meditation at the Lord's table, and Jim for the moving selection of hymns, and all of you because you joined with such earnestness, and I felt with such a worshipful spirit. Oh, how wonderful. And how marvelous is our Savior's love for us. I thought today I would go to the book of Ecclesiastes. It's been thought by many to be a song of cynicism and pessimism. It's far from that. It's a book of great wisdom, actually. And I go frequently, as I live longer, to this book to remind myself of the things I cannot know. Third chapter and verse 11, after that very memorable and well-known series of statements that to everything there's a season, a time for every purpose, he said he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. And the book begins by the statement in the second verse of the first chapter, vanity of vanities, ultimate emptiness, he says. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And then he says again in verse 13 of the chapter, I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of men by which they may be exercised. We have eternity in our hearts, however much sometimes we wish to deny it. We long to understand what is happening in the world, to make sense of it. But Solomon says, what you're going to find here in this world is emptiness and a chasing after the wind. He says that in the beginning of the book. He says it at the conclusion, still pressing the same point. I thought about this particular book because of the recent catastrophe that has struck in this country. A lot of speculations have been made about that tragedy down on the Gulf. Is it a sign of the world's near end, of the coming judgment of God? Well, Jesus said that we won't know about that time. And the so-called physical tremors and disturbances that are mentioned in the 24th chapter of Matthew are said just to be the beginning of sorrows, and besides all that, that had to do with the destruction of Jerusalem, because he said these things will all transpire before this generation is gone. Is it God's punishment for America's sins, a call for repentance? Some have suggested that. I don't know. 104th Psalm, verse 4, says he makes winds his messengers, the flame of fire his servant. Which is to say that God could use all these tragedies to awaken the world. To think that this was the greatest of all disasters is to forget the flood, when God inundated the whole of the earth because of the sins of men. But is this God punishing the United States for the sins of the country? We have plenty to be accountable for. I don't know. To presume to know these things, Solomon says, is beyond us. Some will look at the tragedies, and they're awful down there on the coast. Such devastation we have not known in our lifetime, not the oldest of us. And of course, there was a tsunami that struck the Far East, wreaking havoc everywhere. Was that God's judgment? I'm not sure why that occurred. But I will tell you this, as our brother in his prayer observed. It gives us a lot to think about. We have thought that we were quite secure here with our great wealth and our great technology. And yet this one whirling wind coming out of the Caribbean swept down on the coast of the United States and left it nothing but rubble. Not only that, but we perhaps have finally understood, maybe we have understood, that the economy in this country, which we think is so stable, can be destabilized in a moment by just such a happening or co-location of events. We are not secure. And those of us who live in Kentucky were glad that it happened somewhere on the coast and that we were not living there and that we did not have everything we owned swept away in a trice. We were glad about that, but we are not immune. God's power is immense. The power that races through this universe is immense. And we can be taken down and everything that we have cherished taken away from us. And some have said, as they looked at this event, is there a God? Does he care? All those little children, all those innocent people, all the ravages of their lives, this sudden, swift thing that falls upon them. And how do we make sense out of these things? Not by looking at the world and not by considering it. Not when a man tries to understand everything in nature and in the world without God. That is his vantage point. Solomon made an attempt to make sense out of the world. He tells us that he tried it by human wisdom. Verse 12, I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I set my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom these things. And what he found out was that there's nothing under the sun that indicates we're going anywhere. He took the rotation of the wind around the earth over and over again. Our weather comes from west to east, and that thing just keeps rotating. And it's an endless cycle. And then he took the cycle of the waters as they flow into the ocean, and then from the ocean they're evaporated into the clouds, and the clouds drop their burden again, and then the rivers and the streams bring it back to the ocean. A monotonous repetition of the same old thing. And he said about that, all things are full of labor. Verse 8 of the first chapter, man cannot express it, the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. You don't find out by looking at the world what this is all about. And the attempt on man's part to search out and to find what is the purpose of life by looking at the world is always, always a without profit. And we don't change these circumstances either. I've often observed that we don't have any influence on the world and this cycle of things more than a gnat's eyebrow as it passes over. We don't change anything. Somebody said, well, everything's been changed. Look at all this marvelous technology. It's nothing. Why has that changed the cycle of the winds? How has that changed the cycle of the water? Nothing has changed. And the sense of vanity and emptiness that came over Solomon as a result of this effort. What he said about wisdom, and he's talking here about human wisdom that seeks out to know and to understand how and why things are in verse 18. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. And that is the significance of the statement he made at the end of the book when he said, much study is a weariness of the flesh. Doesn't end up telling us anything. And, also, he said that what he found in the world was irremediable. crookedness, things that were crooked that couldn't be made straight, and things that were lacking that could not be filled. And that's true. He looked at the situation and said, the same end comes the wise and the fool. No difference. Same end. And you can read that in verses 13 through 17 when he's talking about that. It doesn't do you any good to be wise because it's all going to turn out the same way. And then in the third chapter, verses 19 to 21, he said, the same end comes to man and beast. Look and see. As men die, so as beasts die, so men die. Go back to the dust. And not only that, he said, there's no justice in the world. Chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. Because the strong always oppress the weak. I'm telling you, this is true. And not only that, he said about the righteous. You know, we think of ourselves as the righteous of the world. But Solomon looked out and said in chapter 7, verse 15, I have seen everything in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness. And there is a wicked man who prolongs life in his wickedness. Is that true? That is true. Is it always true? No. But it's often true. We've seen the most righteous people we know suffer more than any others. And we've seen people who live in absolute wickedness seem to live life with freedom and health and prosperity. And the 73rd Psalm contains the earnest agony of a person who looked out at the prosperity of the wicked and wondered, why have I cleansed my hands in innocence? Why have I lived a righteous life in view of the fact that it's the wicked who seem to prosper? Well, before the psalm is over, he says, I learned a good lesson. I went to the house of God, and I rethought all that. But that is a problem for men. And then he said, there's life's absolute uncertainty. This explains a lot of things, I suspect. Chapter 9, and verse 11, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill. But time and chance happen to them all. The perspective of Solomon in this great book is Genesis 3, not Genesis 2. Not the world that God made and said, it's good, it's very good. But the world that came because men said, we don't need you. We can take care of things on our own. The spirit of our ancient forebears who said, we'll listen to this snake that comes along. We don't know him, but we'll listen to him because he tells us what we want to hear. And what he's telling us is absolute nonsense, of course. But nonetheless, that was our spirit. And because of that, God subjected the world to vanity. Dust you are, he said, to dust you shall return. No more tree of life. And not only that, but sorrow and troubles and difficulties have come. And nature, I think, has been changed as well. So they're devastating. Always unpredictable. So what he's telling us is that you can't find out what's going on here by your own unaided wisdom, by looking at things under the sun. Verse 11 again of chapter 3, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. I know nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. Why has God masked the universe with such puzzling contradiction? Because he wants us to know we can't know. And he wants us to understand that there are things that are well beyond us and that we need to trust him. That, I think, perhaps is the sentiment of Paul in the first chapter of 1 Corinthians when he speaks about the gospel. And he said in verse 21 of 1 Corinthians 1, for since in the wisdom of God, the world through wisdom did not know God, it pleased God through the foolishness of the message preached to save those that believe. In other words, you don't know anything, and you're not going to find out anything about what's important, vital, and what life is all about by looking at the world and looking inside your own brain, because it only comes from God. He's the only one who knows. No other answers are available. Solomon tried other things. He tried pleasure. And man, did he have an opportunity to do it. Some have called Ecclesiastes lessons from an ex-playboy. I mean, he added everything conceivable to his list of pleasurable activities, and he had the money to do it. You and I are not going to have the money to plumb the depth of pleasure here, but Solomon did, and his conclusion was that it was vanity. That it was emptiness. And we have to learn that lesson the hard way. We will butt our heads up against a brick wall until we have knocked ourselves senseless almost, trying to find meaning through pleasure. It is not there. Are there pleasurable things? There are pleasurable things. What does Solomon say about those pleasurable things? You ought to accept them day to day as they are given to you. Now, we're not talking about sensual pleasure in the sense of some immoral activity. We're not talking about drunkenness. We're talking now about the simple gifts of food and the economic advantages. We are given these things. Well, what should we do with them? Well, don't build your life on them. And if you think it's delightful to be young, I say this to the young people, and it is delightful to be young, and Solomon would counsel you to enjoy it. But don't build your life on it, because it's not going to last either. All these things here, human wisdom, which can never answer the important question, and pleasure, which will never satisfy the spirit, and then wealth. He went through all that. What he concluded about wealth was it would take wings and fly away. I mean, you can have your wealth and you can be taken away from it, or it can be taken away from you. You cannot trust it. You cannot count on it. And I know we do that. We make whatever provisions that we can about our own lives. We buy insurance. We collect our money so that there'll be something we'll have in our retirement days. And we do not know that it will be there. There are plenty of forces that can take it all away. And Solomon said, its temporariness makes it vanity. And then he said, the sorrow the pursuit of it brings. I mean, the rich man can't sleep. But the working man, he said, he can go to sleep at night. He didn't have all those works. He has to take life one day at a time and receive what he gets and trust in that. But the rich man who's trusting in his riches, he cannot get to sleep because he's constantly worrying about that. And then there was the emptiness it leaves. He said, the man that loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor the man that loves abundance with increase. And, you know, that's repeated in many places in the book of Ecclesiastes. It's temporary. The pursuit of it can drive you almost to distraction. The emptiness that it leaves after you've got it, as I've often said, Mercedes is out now. I don't think that's a great automobile, but I guess one of these, and even these big pickups, this astonishes me. This is all free. Why people who will never haul a cow? Who will never be out somewhere hauling hay? Want a pickup truck. And they don't want the bed straps. Put a ladder in there. Put something on top of it. Want the bed straps. Four-wheel drive. And they'll never get off the interstate. And now justice is being done. $3 gasoline. And that thing won't get more than 12, 13, 14 miles a gallon. Anyway, that's just Earnhardt's. Oh, I don't know what it is. But you know, if you get two or three, whatever you think's good now. Right now, I think it's a Volkswagen diesel to get 50 miles a gallon. Or one of these hybrid cars, electric and gasoline, get more than that. That sounds good to me. But if you had, I don't care how many of those you get. You get one of them, that's wonderful. You get two of them, it's delightful. If you get 10 of them, it's boredom gone to sea. And that's what good things, that's what things do. They bore you finally. What are they? Nothing. Dead, inanimate things. And it's just the pointless grind of all that, as Solomon says. He tried it all. None of those things are the purpose of life. You're not going to find any meaning in them. That was Solomon's conclusion. Vanity of vanity. What is our real need? Well, he put eternity in our hearts. That is, he has put something
transcendent in our heart. We want something that will transcend time. We want something that will fill us always and will always be satisfying and always complete us. We want something like that.
We don't know where to find it sometimes. We keep piling all the junk inside to try to satisfy that need, but we don't find it. Who's the only one who can fill our emptiness? I love the hymn, you know, as the deer pants for the water brook. Right out of the book of Psalms, Psalm 42, which tells us something of what will satisfy. As the deer pants for the water brooks, so pants my soul for you, O God.
Now that's somebody who's got it. And recognize that this emptiness that I feel is not going to be satisfied by anything else but the Lord. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? My tears have been my food day and night, while they continue to say to me, where is your God?
So my soul thirsts for God. Same sentiment in the 63rd Psalm.
So how is life filled? Solomon concludes this great discourse after he's knocked everything into the dust because it's all meaningless with a statement that was read before you this morning as the book ends. Verse 9, moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. The preacher sought to find acceptable words, and what was written was upright and words of truth. This is something that lasts. The words of the wise are like goads, and the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd, which I think is a word for the Lord himself. And further, my son, be admonished by these. Of making many books, there is no end, and of much study is weariness to the flesh. Let us consider the conclusion of the matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the all of man. For God will bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil. So I want us to look quickly now at how we fill our lives with things that cannot be taken from us. Fear God. That's what Solomon said. Fear God. That's not terror. John says, 1 John 4, verse 18, that perfect love casts out fear. Not the same idea there. That kind of fear is terror. The kind of deep foreboding that comes into the heart of a person who thinks he's going to stand before God in judgment. Who realizes what kind of life he's lived compared to what the expectations of the Almighty are. That deep foreboding, that's terror. When we know God's love for us and we cast ourselves upon it, that is gone. But not this reverential awe, which is what he's talking about there. Job, in the book of Job, I should say, when Elihu makes his final statements, he says something about this very subject in Job 37 and in verses 22 and 23. You know, it's good to be in Job when you're looking for it. All right, here we are. Job 37. Verses 22 and 23. He comes from the north as gold and splendor, with God his awesome majesty. As for the Almighty, we cannot find him. He is excellent in power, in judgment, and abundant justice. He does not oppress. Therefore, men fear him. He knows no partiality to any who are wise of heart. Therefore, men fear, because of his majestic greatness. And that's the reason for this awestruck fear of God. And we ought to fear him in that sense. The important thing about fearing God is that you cannot find wisdom without that fear. Remember Proverbs twice, the first chapter, and then in the ninth chapter, verse 10. The beginning of wisdom is what? The fear of the Lord. If you're ever going to become wise, if you're ever going to know God's will, it'll be because you come to fear God. The tragedy of the human race is we haven't feared God, and therefore we've not become wise. Paul speaks about that. They refuse to have God in their knowledge, first chapter of Romans.
Knowing God, they did not glorify him as God, but neither gave thanks, but became vain in their reason. There is no way that we're ever going to become wise until the time comes we fall upon our faces and recognize that God is God and we're his creatures. And that he alone knows the truth. And as long as we barrel ahead, determined that we're going to find out for ourselves and take care of our own lives, as long as we do that, so long we will be stupid and foolish and empty of any kind of real knowledge. So it begins, the wisdom begins with the fear of God. That's the wisest thing you can do, is to recognize that God rules the world and that he knows everything that you don't know. And if you're going to find it out, it'll be because he tells you that. And so we have to come to that point. Acts 17, Paul in his address to the Athenians, tells us that the first thing that's important is that we have to come to know God. And the reason for the Athenians' ignorance was that they just did not know him. They worshipped what they did not know. And so Paul says, as he addresses them, speaking about God, verse 24 of the 17th chapter, God who made the world and everything in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Nor is he worshipped with men's hands as though he needed anything, since he gives to all life and breath and all things, and he has made from one blood every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth, and has determined their appointed seasons or times and the boundaries of their dwellings, so that they should seek God or seek the Lord in the hope that they might grope for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. We have to seek to find the Lord. And some of us not looking. Why are we not looking? Why do we suppose that we're going to find some great satisfying delight in this world? And why do we suppose we're going to figure everything out? We are not going to do that. How can it be possible? How can we imagine that it would be possible? We are the creature. We're here by the behest of God. He's the one that gives us life and breath and all things. And therefore, he's the one who knows what we need to know so that we can find at last understanding. So, Solomon says in the 5th chapter of Ecclesiastes, it's a good idea when you come into the presence of God just to be quiet. He warns about some petty person coming before God with his own mouth open. Walk prudently when you go to the house of God and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools. For they do not know that they do evil. Do not be rash with your mouth. Let not your heart utter anything hastily before the Lord, for God is in heaven and you on earth. Therefore let your words be few. The great prophet Habakkuk said, the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him. We don't learn that easily. We think we can just fill in the blanks. We don't know anything. Now let me just emphasize that. We don't know anything about the transcendent purpose of all these things here until God tells us. And we have to listen to learn that. And that's the only way it will be done. Keep his commandments. Fear God, keep his commandments. Psalm 111, something that we've been studying a good bit in the class. Psalm 111 and verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, just as Solomon said in the Proverbs. A good understanding have all those who do his commandments. His praise endures forever. So here what the psalmist is saying is that if we fear God, we will keep his command. That is a part of it. Now, I want to stress something, and this has become important in these days. It's not faith or obedience that we are facing with God. It's not a matter of choosing whether I'm going to just believe in the Lord and trust in the Lord or whether I'm going to obey him. There's no such contrast to that. As James says, if you believe truly, then you will keep the commandments. Faith without works, he said, is dead. And it's not love or obedience. I mean, some people have the idea that if you're set on obeying God, somehow you don't really love him. But there's no such contrast because John says in 1 John 5, 2-3, that this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous. So to believe is to act and to submit, and to love is to obey. And the two are not contradictory. And a fearful obedience begins, as Solomon indicated, with silence, listening to the word and the will of God. Why do we do all God's commands in the scripture? Some people say, because you're a self-righteous legalist. that all this concern to do everything that God said, that is a self-righteous legalism. You're just trying to justify yourself before God by all this law-keeping. Where did that idea come from? Faith, trust in God, means what? Submission. And loving God means obedience. And you can't separate the two of them. Why do you try to do all that God commands in the Scriptures? Because you have a commitment to the Bible? I certainly hope not. I think I've seen some people who just like to read the Bible, and they sort of Bible lawyers, and they get in there because they delight themselves in what they know, and they're committed to the Bible. Well, that's not deep enough. The reason we ought to be committed to what's written in this book is because these are the words of God. And if we believe in Him and trust in Him, then we ought to act upon that. And if we love Him, we ought to want to please Him in everything. And so it's trust in God and love for God that creates that sort of thing. And somebody says, is that all there is? Fear God and keep His commandments? Well, Solomon said that's the whole duty of man. Well, isn't there anything else? There is nothing else. This is what it's about. Fear God and keep His commandments. And the reason we ought to do that with great sobriety is because God will bring every work into judgment. With every secret thing. Whether good or evil. How would you like to have publicized before all these people here every thought you've had, every secret thing, everything that brings you shame just to think about it? How would you like to have that done? The day will come, unless we seek God's mercy and grace, when it'll all be brought out. But God knows it already, of course. So we live in a righteous, justifiable concern about judgment. We want to please the Lord, and we want to be prepared and ready for His coming. I know that there is no reference in the book of Ecclesiastes to the gracious God that sent His Son into the world. That hadn't happened yet. Solomon doesn't deal with that. Does Solomon recognize the sinfulness of man? He absolutely does. He says in the 7th chapter in verse 20 that there is not a righteous, there isn't any man that does not sin. And in verse 29 of the same chapter, that God made man upright, but He sought out many inventions. He recognizes that. And He's not saying by the statement, fear God and keep His commandments, that perfection is demanded, and without perfection, there is no hope for you. He understands the need for that. It's implicit in His book, but later on we see it in the gospel of Christ, that Jesus died for our sins and made it possible for us to fear God and keep His commandments, to walk in righteousness through His grace, and to be acceptable with Him. But we need to be serious about life. All these things can be swept away quickly. We'll be left with empty hands. And if that's what we build our lives on, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity and chasing after the wind. But when you fear God and truly reverence and respect Him and do His will and keep His commandments, then that's what it's about. That's what we're here for. Are you doing what God put you here for? Or are you busy chasing things that are not going to last? That's the question we're raising today. And that is the one we raise with you as this invitation hymn is sung. On what are you building your life? What's the most important thing to you? And have you chosen the thing that you can stand before God in judgment with peace, security and assurance, and say, I'm ready to meet the Lord. While we're standing and singing, if you're not prepared, come and serve the Lord and do His will today while we invite you with this song.